The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tom Klein. I'm here to introduce Jeffrey Toobin. While mere mortals are practicing law every day, many of my colleagues in this room, Jeffrey's been busy analyzing for America and others in the world, everything from the Obama White House to the exploits of O.J. Simpson. Along the way, he's written a careful and brilliant analysis of the inner workings of the United States Supreme Court. If you have just decided to come to this event and to read American Heiress, The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst, you're missing the other great books that were written by Jeff Toobin. He is a lawyer. He is a, as you know, CNN commentator. He writes for the New Yorker. He is going to be on. We all can run home tonight if the logistics work out for him, which I've encouraged backstage. He'll be on CNN at 10 p.m. tonight, and you'll learn about the latest exploits of one of the two people who are running for president of the United States who happens to be a male. And it is with great pleasure, and I'll get totally out of the way for Jeffrey Toobin.
Thanks, Tom. Hello, everyone. It's great to be in Philadelphia. Can I brag? I've bragged several times already today. My dad, Overbrook High School, Temple, Tasty Cakes. I grew up coming to Philly a lot and have been to Philadelphia a lot many times. And I did something today that I'd never done before, because, you know, I live in New York and I always take the train. And I actually flew in from Pittsburgh today, so I was at the airport. I'm almost never at the Philadelphia airport. And I went to the International Arrivals Building. Now, I know, I'm sure in a fancy group like this, many of you have flown into the International Arrivals Building, and you know that there's this remarkable room with the excerpts from the Declaration of Independence written along the walls and a blown-up copy of the Declaration of Independence. That was designed by my beloved late uncle, Rob Fisher. Isn't that a cool thing? And he lived in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, outside State College. And I'm going to devote my entire remarks tonight to my family. No, I'm not. I'm here to talk about the Patty Hearst case. And, you know, I started work on this book, and I didn't really... I was alive, I am somewhat pleased to say, during the 1970s. But I was a kid, and I didn't really know much about the 1970s. And the indispensable background to this story is what was going on in the United States in the 1970s. And, you know, there are many ways to tell you about the 1970s. You know, I thought in my naivete that the 60s was the time that the country was convulsed in anger and rancor and riots, and the 70s things sort of mellowed out. Well, I could not have been more wrong. Let me tell you one statistic about the 1970s, the early and mid-1970s. There were 1,000 political bombings a year in the United States. Think about that. What would Fox News do with 1,000 political bombings a year? There were two hijackings a month. Remember skyjackings, taking the planes to Cuba? And the epicenter of the violence and the rancor of that period was the Bay Area, and especially in San Francisco. And you know, I grew up as an adult thinking of San Francisco as this idyllic city by the bay, this wealthy city near, you know, Silicon Valley and prosperous. And San Francisco was such a hellhole in the 1970s, it's true, that Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry was a San Francisco detective because they wanted him to work in the most dangerous city in America, which this was. The Zodiac Killer, the serial killer whose identity is still unknown. The Zebra Killers, who were these roving bands of black Muslims, a splinter group of black Muslims, who grabbed white people off the street because they were white, for no other reason, killed them, or alternatively, took them to a warehouse and tortured them to death. This was San Francisco in the 1970s. And this is the indispensable background for what was going on in the that led to the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. Another thing that is worth knowing about the 1970s, especially in California, is that prisons were a hotbed of political activity. That the people who were involved in the counterculture, the people who stayed involved after the draft ended, you sort of the hardcore, they thought that all prisoners were political prisoners. And they went to prisons to organize and to educate prisoners. And the prison that is nearest to Berkeley, California, which of course was the center of this activity, is a prison called Vacaville, about 40 miles away from, and there was a prisoner there named Donald DeFries. Donald DeFries was basically a full-time criminal for his whole life. He was about 30 years old in the early 70s, and he had led a life of petty and not-so-petty crime, but he started to see these kids, white, middle-class kids, coming to prison and wanting to commune with the prisoners and learn with the prisoners. And DeFries sort of knew a good thing when he saw one, especially because some of these visitors were women and the rules were pretty loose about contact. So there was actually sex going on that was a big part of, again, what was going on in the 70s. And DeFries decided that he was going to be a political activist as well. He basically knew nothing about politics, but he sort of responded to these groups. And he ultimately was transferred to Soledad Prison, escaped from Soledad Prison in the middle of 1973, and where did he go? He went back to Berkeley because he knew that's where he would find a sympathetic audience, and that's where he found, that's where he created the Symbionese Liberation Army. And he was the one who named it. And the first question that people always ask is, well, what the hell is Symbionese? And that the answer to that is Donald DeFries thought that symbiosis was an important phenomenon, that people should work together. And so he created the word Symbionese. The middle word is liberation. I assure you, the Symbionese Liberation Army didn't liberate anything or anyone. And as an army, at its maximum, the Symbionese Liberation Army had about a dozen people in it. So this was hardly an army, but it was created by Donald DeFries, and he became obsessed in San Francisco, in Berkeley, with one person in particular, Marcus Foster. Marcus Foster was the school superintendent of Oakland, and a heroic African-American educator who was from Philadelphia. And he had actually been the deputy commissioner here in Philly before he went to Oakland. And he was really trying to do his best in an extremely difficult situation in Oakland. But DeFries, in his delusional pathology, thought that Foster was a sellout to the black community and someone who was a competitor for leadership in California. And so one day, November 11th, 1973, DeFries and two of his followers ambushed Marcus Foster outside the offices of the school board, and they assassinated him. They shot him dead on the street. Just to this day, one of the more remarkable and bizarre and horrifying crimes. And it was so horrifying that it generated no support even from the most radical elements of the counterculture. The Black Panthers wanted nothing to do with this. The Weather Underground wanted nothing to do with this. So from the very beginning, the core of the SLA was isolated. Yet there were people who gravitated towards them. And the group that gravitated towards him were three people in particular, Bill and Emily Harris, a married couple, and Angela Atwood, who had something in common. They came from the Indiana University Theater Program. It's true. Where they performed with Kevin Kline, the actor, who's Kevin Kline. And Angela Atwood was in a sorority, the Kappa Kappa Gammas, where she was in a singing group with Jane Pauley, the former anchor of the Today Show. Like, go figure, right? I don't know. They brought a different sensibility to what became the Symbionese Liberation Army. This was the time of guerrilla theater, political theater, and they wanted to use the notoriety that they had from this horrible assassination to generate even more attention. In January of 1974, two of the SLA members were arrested. They were caught and charged with the murder of Marcus Foster. So they recognized they needed to do something in response. And so what they did was they decided, you know, this whole assassination business didn't work out so well. But maybe we can kidnap somebody and trade them for our two comrades who were arrested. Well, who were they going to kidnap? Well, the guerrilla theater people, the Harrises, Atwood, they said, we need to make a splash. We can't just kidnap anybody. And it just so happened at right around that time, in the San Francisco Examiner, there was a wedding announcement, an engagement announcement, of Patricia Hearst and her boyfriend, Stephen Weed. And the wedding announcement mentioned in about the fourth paragraph that Patty Hearst was a sophomore at the University of California at Berkeley. And Emily Harris was working as a secretary at that time at Berkeley, at the university, and she knew in that more innocent time that there was a big leather binder open to the public where it listed the name and address of every undergraduate at Berkeley. So one day, Bill Harris went over to the leather binder and looked up Patricia Hearst and saw 2603 Benvenue, apartment 4, which is a quiet street in Berkeley, pretty little apartment building of four apartments, and that's where she lived. And they decided that the splash they could make was to kidnap the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst. And, you know, at the remove of 40 years, it's difficult to convey what the Hearst name meant in 1974, because this was a time when newspapers were still ascendant. Remember newspapers? The Hearst was the most famous name in newspapers. William Randolph Hearst died a couple of years before Patricia was born, but his name still resonated. He was the creator of a newspaper empire that included the San Francisco Examiner. He was the owner of the grandest private residence in the United States, San Simeon. He was the inspiration for what is often regarded as the greatest film in American history, Citizen Kane. And the Hearst name, especially in Northern California, was, you know, it defined wealth and power. So the SLA knew where she lived. They started staking her out, and they learned her patterns. And on the night of February 4th, 1974, three people, Donald DeFries, who had renamed himself General Field Marshal Sincue, Bill Harris, and Angela Atwood, knocked on the door of apartment 4, and Angela Atwood said, I think we may have bumped into your car. And Stephen Weed opened the door, and the three of them burst in. They hit Stephen Weed with a sap, a metal instrument, and Stephen Weed at that point ran out the door and fled. They grabbed Patricia, dragged her down the stairs, threw her in the trunk of the car that they had carjacked just moments earlier in downtown Berkeley, and drove off into the night and wound up in a small house in Daly City, which is a blue-collar suburb of San Francisco, and they put Patty in a closet that they had prepared with a mattress on the floor, and she was there by herself, alone, in this extraordinarily terrifying situation. Well, who was Patty Hearst in February of 1974? Well, she was 19 years old, 2 weeks short of her 20th birthday. She was the slightly rebellious daughter of Catherine and Randy Hearst. Randy Hearst was one of the four sons of William Randolph Hearst, each one a bigger drunk and ne'er-do-well than the next one. And Catherine Hearst was an old-fashioned, angry, if you'd been married to Randy Hearst, too, you might be angry as well, conservative Southern belle from Atlanta who, like a lot of mothers of 18-year-olds, was locked in combat with her daughter. She was, Patty Hearst was, in the phrase of that day, living in sin with her boyfriend. She was engaged, but here is the critical fact about Patty Hearst in February of 1974. She was unhappily engaged. She did not want to marry Stephen Weed. But she didn't want to admit to her mother that she'd made a mistake. She was in a restless and uncertain moment in her life. The SLA, of course, knew none of this. All they knew that she was a Hearst and that she was a student, but they had found a young woman who was at a turning point in her life and a vulnerable point in her life. And she was kidnapped and in the closet. And in the best SLA tradition, they kidnapped her, and they thought, well, what do we do now? Because they really didn't have much of a plan for what to do. They thought originally that, well, maybe we'll trade Patty Hearst for our two comrades. But even they recognized that Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California at the time, wasn't going to let two accused murderers just go because someone had been kidnapped. So that idea was pretty much a non-starter from the start. But then the guerrilla theater folks had an idea. Well, what if we make a demand that's not for money, but something for the good of the community? What if we say to Randy Hearst, as a show of good faith to us, feed the poor of California, spend $4 million, which was a considerable sum in those days, to set up an organization to give away free food. And Randy Hearst, in really a rather extraordinarily short period of time, did just that. He set up an organization called People in Need. They rented a warehouse in downtown San Francisco, and they gave away food. Now, it will not surprise you to learn, it didn't go smoothly. It was there were even some near riots in the food distribution, but they that's what they did. And as this was happening over the next few days, the early weeks, the door to the closet started opening, and Patricia started talking with her captors. And they started talking to her, and they started saying, look, we're not out to get you. We're out to save the world. We're out to feed the poor. Look what's going on. You don't have anything to fear from us, they said. What you have to fear is that the FBI and the police storm this house and kill us all. That's the only risk you face. And one of the kidnappers in particular was very close in age to Patty, and actually similar in background, although not nearly as wealthy. Willie Wolfe came from a small town in Connecticut, where his father was a physician, and he'd gone to prep school, and he'd gone to Berkeley, and he started spending time with Patty Hearst, and Patty Hearst liked him, and they started to get along. And the degree to which they did get along remains a contested fact in this case, but it is clear that there was a relationship of some kind. And eventually, between Donald DeFries and Angela Atwood and Willie Wolfe, they were talking to Patty, telling her that we're not against you, it's the FBI that is against you, and it's your family that's screwing up this food delivery. They're the ones who are abandoning you. And in relatively short order, Patty Hearst changed sides. Now, this is, of course, the most contested fact about this whole story, about whether Patty Hearst did, in fact, change sides. But I am here to tell you that it is my belief, based on the evidence, that she did. How do I know? Well, on April 15th, just 6 weeks after she's kidnapped, a couple weeks before that, May 31st, she sends a communique, a tape recording, that says, I have changed sides. I have decided to stay and fight. And as I'm sure many of you remember, she said, I am taking a new name. My name is Tanya. And Tanya, that name was not chosen at random. That was the name of Che Guevara's partner and lover, who died with him in the hills of Bolivia. So that was a symbolically resonant name that she took. April 15th, the SLA, with their taste for theater, they wanted to find a bank that had a relatively new technological innovation, a security camera. And they found one in the Sunset section, a quiet part of San Francisco, and they staged a bank robbery, and they put Patty Hearst with her machine gun in precisely the location of the bank where they knew she would be photographed by the security cameras. And she was, and of course that became a very famous image of the 1970s, but not as famous as the photograph taken back in the hideout where the SLA was hiding, in front of the SLA's flag with its symbol of the seven-headed cobra, with Patty Hearst standing with a machine gun. That photograph, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, take a look at it. I hope you take a look at it in my book. I refer to it, and I'm not being facetious, as a kind of Mona Lisa of the 1970s, because it is her expression is deeply inscrutable. You cannot tell if she is happy or sad, terrified or proud. It is open to as many interpretations as the Hearst story as a whole, and that is the photograph that symbolized her transformation from Patty to Tanya. Okay, April 15th is the bank robbery. The SLA decides that the heat has gotten too great in San Francisco, so they need to take off. They got $11,000 in the bank robbery. They're flush for the moment. They flee, nine of them, to Los Angeles. And they rent a little house. And in short order, they start to go stir crazy. And they're like stuck in this house. What are they? As usual, they had no idea really what they were going to do. But so three of the nine, Bill and Emily Harris and Patricia, decide to go shopping. They go to buy some food. They go to buy some newspapers. And on the afternoon of May 16th, 1974, they go to buy some clothes. And they go to a place in Inglewood, California, called Mel's Sporting Goods. And Bill and Emily Harris go inside the store, and they leave Patricia in the van alone across the street where it's parked. Now, keep in mind, she's alone in the van. The key's in the ignition. She could get up and leave. She could drive away. She could go home. She could go to the police. She could go to a hospital. She doesn't do that. She sits and she waits in the van alone while Bill and Emily Harris go to Mel's Sporting Goods. What happens in Mel's Sporting Goods? Well, Bill Harris, genius that he is, decides to shoplift. And the clerk in Mel's Sporting Goods is an aspiring police officer. And he knows, Anthony Shepard, the aspiring police officer, knows that the crime of shoplifting does not actually take place until the perpetrator leaves the premises of the store. So he sees Bill stuffing like socks and a bandolier into his pants, but waits for Bill to leave the hall, leave the store. But once Bill and Emily go onto the sidewalk, Anthony confronts him and tackles him. Emily jumps onto the pile. As bystanders jump onto the pile, there's a melee in front of Mel's Sporting Goods. Meanwhile, Patricia is across the street alone in the van. And what does she do? Does she drive away? Does she leave? No. Patricia Hearst takes a machine gun in the back of the van, points it out the window, and sprays a fusillade. I never had to say that word. Fusillade. You get a lot of shots across the street to try to free Bill and Emily Harris. Miraculously, she doesn't hit anybody, but she doesn't free them at first. So once she empties one machine gun, she picks up another and shoots across the street, and ultimately succeeds in getting these people off, literally off Bill's back, and the Bill and Emily rejoin her in the van. They recognize that the three of them are now going to be wanted because of this huge shootout that just went on. So Emily Harris had a summer job a few years earlier at Disneyland. So the three of them decide to go to Disneyland. They check in to a motel across the street from Disneyland, and they turn on the TV. And they see an extraordinary sight. They see that the Los Angeles Police Department has surrounded the little house. And there's a new invention in the American media. There's something called the minicam, where live events could be broadcast immediately. And this was the first breaking news live event that was picked up across the country. Because when the LAPD had a loudspeaker that said, come out with your hands up, they were met by gunfire. And what followed outside that little house in South Central Los Angeles was the biggest gun battle involving the police in American history to this day. The LAPD fired 5,000 rounds of ammunition into the house. The SLA fires 3,000 rounds of ammunition out of the house. And ultimately, the house catches fire. And all six people inside are killed. Willie Wolfe, Donald DeFries, Angela Atwood, Nancy Ling Perry, Ms. Moon Soltysik, Camilla Hall. All six of the eight kidnappers are killed as Bill and Emily and Patricia watch on television across the street from Disneyland. And Patricia sees that the SLA's prophecy has come true. The police thought Patricia was in that house, but they fired anyway. And the prophecy that you have only the FBI to fear has come true. And that cements her decision to join with the Symbionese Liberation Army. Now, let me sort of, what follows from May 17th, 1974, is what's known to those of us in the industry as Patty's lost year. She goes on the run with Bill and Emily Harris, and she ultimately joins with a ragtag band of others, someone named Jack Scott, Wendy Yoshimura. They drive across country. They go actually not too far from here to a farm in outside Scranton, where they spend several months trying to write a book. Like many people, they discover it's kind of hard to write a book. So it doesn't really work out, and they head back west. And when they move west, they settle in Sacramento, California. There, they're running out of money. So, as they did before, they decide to rob banks. So they rob one bank fairly successfully. They rob a second bank, which is actually their third bank robbery, and that doesn't go so well. Emily Harris's gun discharges in the course of that bank robbery, and a customer, a young woman named Myrna Opsahl, is killed in the bank. And Patricia drives the getaway car that day. Ultimately, they go to San Francisco, and Patricia has subsequently fallen in love with another one of the SLA members, a guy named Steve Solia. She's living with him. And they are arrested together at long last on September 15th, 1975. So she is with the SLA from February of 74 to September of 1975. And on the day she is arrested, she is booked the way, you know, the way people are. And you have to give your name and your address and your occupation. And Patricia says her name is Patricia Hearst, and her occupation is urban guerrilla, which it was. I mean, that was her occupation. And she writes a series of letters to Steve Solia from prison, which I write in the book, where she talks about how we're going to continue our revolutionary activities from prison. Well, in short order, just as in the closet, she decided she wanted to be a member of the SLA, in her jail cell, she decided that she wanted to be a Hearst again. There's a trial of for the original bank robbery of the Hibernia Bank, and she's represented by the celebrated attorney F. Lee Bailey, and she testifies, and she's convicted, and she's sentenced to 7 years, 7 years in prison. Something happens shortly after she begins serving her prison sentence. As part of the madness of the 1970s in San Francisco, I'm sure you will remember the Reverend Jim Jones in the People's Temple, where he brought about 900 of his followers to the small nation of Guyana in San Francisco. And when they were confronted by a congressman, Jones commanded them all to commit suicide together. They drank poison Kool-Aid. Many people here to this day use the expression, you know, drank the Kool-Aid. Many people don't even remember that that's the origin of that expression. But there is a mass suicide. And the subject of how do you get people to do things that are against their interest, brainwashing, becomes very current. And Jimmy Carter follows that debate, and Ronald Reagan follows that debate. Ronald Reagan, who's the governor of California, a friend of the Hearst family, urges Jimmy Carter to pardon or commute the sentence of Patricia Hearst. And others in the Bay Area do the same, and she does. And Jimmy Carter does. After 22 months, Patricia Hearst's sentence is commuted, and she's released from prison, and she marries her bodyguard, Bernie Shaw. And remarkably, perhaps, she goes on to live the life for which she was destined. Bernie and Patty move to the New York area. They live in the New York suburbs. They have two girls. Patty Hearst is a homemaker, a wealthy socialite. She does a few colorful things. She acts in a couple movies. She writes a book. She writes a mystery. But she leads the life for which she is destined. And towards the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, she decides that a commutation is not good enough. She wants a pardon, too. And she organizes a campaign which includes former President Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter to get Bill Clinton to pardon her. And on the last day of Bill Clinton's presidency, on the same day that he pardons Mark Rich, the financier, his brother Roger Clinton, Bill Clinton issues a full pardon to Patty Hearst. So Patty Hearst is to this day the only person in America to receive a commutation from one president and a pardon from another. And that is a story about wealth and privilege in America. And that leads me to ask you if you have any questions about this story. Thank you. Thank you. Andy, so lead the way. Josiah's.
Sure. If you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off?
You've got your version of Patty Hearst's story out there. Now she finally agrees to be interviewed by you for, let's say, an addendum to a paperback edition, whatever it might be. What would you ask her?
Well, One of the good things. I mean, I'm sorry I didn't have her cooperation in this book. I can understand why. She's 62 years old. This is a part of her past. She's moved on. She doesn't want to talk about this anymore. I respect that rationale. She has given many interviews over the years to mostly to journalists who don't know the facts of the case very well, so they don't ask her about Mel's Sporting Goods. They don't ask her about the death of Myrna Opsahl. They don't ask her about the time that she and Steve Solia go hiking and they get trapped in an inaccessible area where the state police come and rescue them. And she doesn't say, oh, by the way, I'm Patty Hearst, can you take me home? They don't ask about the time she gets poison oak and Steve Solia takes her to the hospital to get treatment, and she doesn't say to the nurse, oh, by the way, I'm Patty Hearst, can you, she is rarely asked, about all the opportunities she had to leave and all the crimes that she committed while she was on the run for that year. That's what I'd ask.
Could you tell us a little bit about your sources, both personal interviews and archives of things, and how long did it take you to put this together?
As books go, it was pretty fast. I mean, it was about 2 years. The key source material. I mean, one of the things. This is the first book I've written that was sort of at the border between history and journalism. You know, all the other books I'd written were stories I covered in real time and then wrote a book about. And so it was novel for me. And I was worried that, 40 years hence, there wouldn't be anybody around to talk to. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised that most of the protagonists, not all of them, were still alive and willing to talk. The key documentary piece of that I had was from Bill Harris. Bill Harris served 6 years in prison for kidnapping Patty Hearst. He later served about 6 years in prison in connection with the bank robbery where Myrna Opsahl died. But in between, he worked as a private investigator in San Francisco, in quite a good room, from what I understand. And he is a sort of very obsessive character, and he made a hobby of collecting all the documents in connection with the SLA. All the trial documents of all the different trials, all the discovery material, the FBI 302s, the interview notes of the FBI agents, the grand jury testimony. And when I met Bill Harris, he had just had a deal to sell this material, 150 boxes, to a university library fall through. So I bought it from him instead. And I will when this book is, you know, done and launched, I'm going to give those 150 boxes to the Harvard Law School Library, which has all my papers, and anyone else can, you know, look at them and make it of what they will. The single best document that I got out of those 150 boxes was a chronology that private investigators on behalf of the defense created based on their interviews with all the SLA people. It was basically the 60-page chronology of the SLA's version of events. Bill Harris's version, Emily Harris's version. Needless to say, I didn't take that as face value, as the gospel truth, but it was extremely helpful to me to see where the distinctions were between her, you know, Patty Hearst's story and their story. In many respects, the stories line up. I mean, the facts are not really, most of the facts are not really in dispute. Mostly what's in dispute is Patty's motivation. Was she forced to do what she did, or was she voluntary? But that was the key turning point in my research, getting those 150 boxes.
You kind of answered my question. I was really wondering what attracted you to the story. And then also...
Wasn't this good story?
Yes.
I mean, I was trying. I was selling it, man. And it's a pretty good story, you know? I mean.
And the other thing I wanted to say is that I went to high school and was pretty close to Angela DeAngelis, who was Angela Atwood. And so this was, when we heard about this, this was just horrifying and so sad. And I brought my yearbook to show you.
Oh.
I was on the cheerleading squad with her.
You were on the cheer. Well, you know,
so
I don't know. Maybe some of you heard. I was on WHYY today with Marty Moss-Cohen, a high school classmate of Ms. Moon Soltysik, one of the other kidnappers, called in and said, you know, I was in high school with her. And you know, one of the things about the SLA that, is so interesting is that it was, of the eight who were sort of the core, three men and five women. The women were almost, four of the five were cheerleaders. They were middle-class kids. You know, Jane Pauley went to Indiana University with Angela DeAngelis and said this was the most beautiful woman in the whole university. People would stop to look at her. She was charismatic. And, you know, this is part of why this story is topical, I think, because, you know, we live in a world where people become radicalized. And you know, we have Somali kids in Minnesota who decide to join ISIS. We have kids who grow up in Brussels who decide to join ISIS. What is it that makes middle-class, upstanding, intact family kids join in these mad enterprises? And the short answer is, we don't know. Many of these kids who grow up in identical circumstances, you know, are horrified at the thought of joining these operations. But others join in. What is, and you know, what made Patty do what she did? You know, it is a very difficult, interesting question. And anyway, I'd very much like to see the yearbook. Thank you.
Right in the front row here, and then we'll go to the lady in the fifth row, Barbara.
How does a nice young AUSA get into this stuff?
Well, I assume you mean me. I was an AUSA, and you know, I guess the short answer is both my parents were journalists. My dad was a producer at public television in New York, and my mom, as I suspect some of you know, was Marlene Sanders, who was one of the pioneering television correspondents of the starting in the 1960s. Alas, she just died last summer. And so, you know, I went to law school and I practiced law as a prosecutor for 6 years, but, you know, I sometimes think of it as sort of my genetic destiny kicked in. And so I think that's, you know, as good an answer as I can come up with.
Barbara?
If memory serves correctly, this was when we first really heard about the Stockholm Syndrome. Could you talk a little bit about that and what else that you know, how that plays into it.
You know, it's funny. This the Patty Hearst story is very much associated with the concept of the Stockholm Syndrome. The Stockholm Syndrome was named after a bank robbery that took place in Sweden, obviously, in November of 1973, where the bank robbers took some hostages, and ultimately the hostages, by telephone, sort of advocated on behalf of the hostage takers. November of 1973 was just 3 months before the kidnapping. The concept of Stockholm Syndrome had not really yet reached into the public consciousness in the United States yet at the time of the Patty Hearst kidnapping. And in fact, Stockholm Syndrome was never mentioned in her trial. It's only after the fact that it became associated. But Bailey's defense of Patricia was based on the concept of brainwashing. Now, one of the things I tried to do in writing American Heiress was avoid journalistic jargon about psychiatry. I mean, I talk about Stockholm Syndrome, I talk about brainwashing, but it is important to remember that Stockholm Syndrome and brainwashing are journalistic terms. They are not medical terms. And while there have been recognized cases of people doing things they shouldn't have done because they were talked into it, or people advocating on behalf of people who did bad things to them, this is not a recognized medical phenomenon. And all of these situations are unique. So it was my preference in writing this book to talk about what actually happened rather than impose these concepts that really are not terribly useful. But, you know, since the case always gets talked about that way, and because there were six psychiatrists who testified at her trial, three for the prosecution and three for the defense, you know, I do address some of these issues, but just as a general matter, that was my approach. But Stockholm Syndrome is only sort of after the fact associated with the case. It wasn't in the trial.
You wrote about O.J., and of course we know what happened there, and Johnny Cochran's success. Is there anything that you saw in the transcript that F. Lee Bailey could have done which would have exonerated her then and there?
F. Lee Bailey in the Hearst case?
In the Hearst case, yes.
Yes. Yeah, he made one catastrophic error. He put Patty Hearst on the stand to testify about what she went on. Not an irrational decision in and of itself, but he put her on the witness stand without getting a clear ruling from the judge in advance about what the scope of cross-examination would be. Now, to the lawyers in the audience, he didn't get a motion in limine about the scope of cross-examination. He thought, putting her on the witness stand, that he had a ruling from the judge that the shootout at Mel's, the two other bank robberies, would be off limits for cross-examination. But there was no such ruling. And Jim Browning, the prosecutor, not surprisingly, went straight at these issues in the course of cross-examination. Bailey objected, outside the scope of the direct, irrelevant. Browning, the judge, Oliver Carter, ruled for the prosecution, said, you are allowed to question about these other activities. And keep in mind, as the driver of a getaway car in a bank robbery where a woman was killed, that's a felony murder. That's potentially even a death penalty case. So F. Lee Bailey, given the only opportunity that he had, told Patricia to take the fifth in front of the jury about all these other crimes. A defendant who testifies and takes the fifth in front of the jury is not so good. You know, it's and so either Bailey should have gotten a clear ruling or not had her take the stand at all. I mean, the jury knew she was kidnapped. So that was part of the evidence in the case. I think putting her on the witness stand was a catastrophic error, particularly under these circumstances.
That's a beautiful talk and a beautiful book. Here I am.
Oh, I'm sorry. There.
And so congratulations.
Thank you.
But my question has to do with the kind of implicit theory about the 1960s and 1970s in the book, which is, if I exaggerate a bit, it's that sometime in the 1960s, thousands of Martians descended onto the planet, pillaged and rampaged, and then somehow vanished. There's no real explanation for why all that happened. Is that really the best we can do?
No, I mean, look, first of all, this book is not like a history of the 60s and 70s. It's a very specific story in context. But my view, to the extent I have a larger view of the 60s and 70s, is that in the 1960s, especially on the issues of civil rights for African Americans and the Vietnam War, there was tremendous popular outrage and enormous numbers of peaceful protests. And that was an important and noble part of American life in the 1960s. Richard Nixon ended the Vietnam draft in the early 1970s. That drained a lot of the middle class support for these issues out of the people who were still active. So it tended to be just the hardcore who was left. Similarly, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the moral imperatives of the civil rights movement became murkier than they had been. And there was an element of exhaustion as well. So the people who were left in the counterculture, the people who had been behind the free speech movement in 1965 in Berkeley, the people in the Summer of Love in San Francisco in 1967, by the 70s, all of that, not all of it, or much of that idealism had curdled and turned uglier. And that was the pool from which the SLA drew. So that's sort of my general take on the matter.
Thanks so much for your speech. It was really, it was brilliant.
Thank you.
Is your prosecutor's sense of justice tarnished at all by the results in some of these cases that you've followed, or even Mark Rich and Roger Clinton, whom you've mentioned tonight? It kind of blows my mind, and I wondered, what do you think about the service of justice here?
I am not an apologist for the criminal justice system. I recognize that there a lot of bad things happen in our legal system. But one of the flaws, I think, in media coverage, perhaps it's inevitable, of high profile cases, is that we, and thus our viewers, readers, extrapolate how the criminal justice system works from these handful of high-profile cases. The O.J. Simpson case being the paradigmatic example, that O.J. Simpson, with 10 defense lawyers in a case prosecuted by 7 prosecutors, winds up getting acquitted in a trial that lasts 8 months. That is not how most trials unfold in this country, to say nothing of their being televised. I think everyday justice in America has a lot of problems that are not really illuminated by the pardon of Mark Rich or even the pardon of Patty Hearst. And I just refer you to a really terrific book by a Los Angeles Times reporter named Jill Leovi. This book is called Ghettocide. I don't know if some of you may have read it, which is a story about sort of murders, the murders that went on in South Central Los Angeles right around the time of the O.J. Simpson case. And if you want to know about the real world of criminal justice and not the Dream Team and Cato Kalin and all the rest of the spectacle, read Ghettocide. And you'll learn a lot about the real world. I certainly did.
Thank you very much. So people that accomplish as much as you do have to sacrifice something. You have books, and by the way, The Oath was really great, and the articles, and The New Yorker, and the CNN. But these things take so many hours of work. So what do you sacrifice?
My career in professional sports. You know? I was reminded there was a moment in law school where we were having one of these sort of, the professor was having one of these very serious discussions with all of us about why we went to law school, and we were all like saying, oh, I want to do justice, and I want to do, I want to help people, and there was a classmate of mine, Dave. Everybody in my law school class remembers this moment. And you know, Dave had been very quiet during the discussion, and finally the professor called on Dave, and he said, "Look, I wouldn't be here at all if I could hit the curveball." neither would I. I feel very lucky. I have a wonderful family. I have these interesting jobs. I have the same dilemmas and problems as most people. But you know, I am very much aware that you know most people who write books don't get to talk in front of a group like this and don't get you know the nice sales and a book tour and all that. And I just feel very fortunate to have the life that I do. I mean, that's just sort of...
I think we can all agree he hit it out of the park, Jeffrey Toobin.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.